Thanks for choosing All Things Peoria today. I'm Daniel Musisi. Whether you're chowing down in a Bradley University dining hall or a local restaurant, there's a good chance your leftovers are ending up not in the landfill, but in the hands of Better Earth Compost. The Peoria Company finds greener solutions for your food scraps. WCBU correspondent Mike Rundle recently visited their expansive facility to learn more.
When Better Earth Compost launched in 1998, the mission was to help the community in a new way. Now, 23 years later, that mission remains the same. Founded by Paul and June Rosenbaum, who were primarily dairy farmers, Better Earth Compost first launched as a method of processing manure produced by their own farm as well as their neighbors. Now, led by Paul and June's son Luke and his wife Yvonne, Better Earth Compost is working with local universities, restaurants, and residents to turn organic waste into nutrient-rich compost. Whether it's yard waste from an ongoing contract with Peoria Disposal Company or food scraps from the dining halls at Bradley University, when organic waste arrives at the facility, it is quickly processed and placed in windrows to start the aerobic composting process.
It's like baking a cake. So you got to have the right ingredients, and then you got to have the oven on at the right temperatures. So we're getting our temperatures up to 130 to 150 degrees consistently.
Rosenbaum reiterates that with any material Better Earth takes in, the end goal is to manipulate it into a retail-ready product, a problem he is excited to solve.
We're not a landfill, so everything that comes in eventually goes out. And so basically everything just has a lease on the land here. At some point, the lease is up and it's got to go.
Using that same problem-solving energy, Rosenbaum brought Tremont-based organization Tazewell County Resource Centers into the Better Earth system. Community food sales supervisor Amanda Rudd says Better Earth was able to present a more cost-effective solution for the business compared to typical trash removal.
We were able to cut down our commercial garbage pickup from twice a week to once a week, and it not only offset any costs and covered any costs from what Better Earth was charging, but PCRC as a whole organization is saving thousands of dollars every year because of that switch.
Rudd also says that their involvement with Better Earth comes full circle in the form of a farmer's market made possible by a collaboration with the Miller Center in Pekin.
We were able to come full circle and start off the year in our garden using Better Earth compost, and we were able to produce a lot of vegetables throughout the season to provide produce at the Pekin Farmers Market. So that was just really, really cool to feel like our food waste went to that compost and now we're using it to grow our garden.
Rosenbaum says Better Earth also saw an uptick in gardening that correlated with the beginning of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. After a busy 2020, they expected 2021 to return to a normal pace, but business has continued to boom.
But I think a lot of it was people finally had time to do something they've always wanted to do. I think society slowed down a little bit to where people could reallocate their priorities.
Dr. Sherry Morris, chair of the biology department and co-director of the Center for STEM Education at Bradley University, says that from a biology perspective, gardening with compost is one of the best things you can do to improve growth.
Compost really provides a really, really nice source of nutrients for those plants. So those plants can grow bigger, they can grow faster, and get to the nutrients that they need without putting down more roots.
With more local residents seeking out Better Earth products, Rosenbaum hopes the composting process will begin to appeal to more people. He believes that education is the best tool for expanding their mission to reduce food waste in landfills, and that education should start early in life.
If we really want to see this going somewhere great, we've got to get the younger kids involved so that way we can train an entire generation. Nothing pushes a movement better than the kids saying, "This is what we need to do."
Rosenbaum hopes to continue his efforts to make the future a little brighter for his and Yvonne's two children, and one day he hopes to be bested by them.
This is something that we can do now, and I always say this. I hope my boys sit there when they're in their 30s and say, "Dad, I can't believe this was the only solution you could come up with. We found something way better."
To start composting with Better Earth, Rosenbaum encourages residents to check out their community compost kiosk program. I'm Mike Rundle.
To learn more about the work of the Rosenbaum family at Better Earth Compost, find the full story now at WCBU.org. And in about 8 minutes on All Things Peoria, listen for Out and About. Host Jen Gordon of Arts Partners talks to Wendy Thomason of the Peoria Ballet about their upcoming performance of The Nutcracker. Good afternoon, I'm Daniel Musisi, and this is All Things Peoria. Local historian and storyteller Brian Fox Ellis has spent a lot of time looking into and telling stories about the Illinois River. In this episode of WCBU's history series, Postmark Peoria, correspondent Steve Tarter talks to Ellis about the role the river played before central Illinois residents had electricity in their homes. It served a vital purpose in winter as a supplier of ice.
It's hard to believe today, but back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, when the ice business was booming, the Illinois River was surprisingly clear and clean. There are places, especially on some of the backwater sloughs that are now all silted in, where the water was 20 or 30 feet deep and you could see the pebbles and rocks on the bottom. And there was a great profusion of water lilies and other aquatic plants because the sunlight could penetrate the water. It wasn't as murky or muddy as it appears today. And so ice off the Illinois River was highly valued, and it was a major industry. Just a couple of numbers off the top of my head. Detweiler had a warehouse that would hold more than 10,000 tons. 10,000 tons of ice, which you do the math, was more than 21 million pounds. And of course, they sold it by the pound.
Wow. And then we're talking about Henri Detweiler, the riverboat captain and entrepreneur and many other things.
Yes.
But there were others doing that too, right?
Right. So Detweiler started as a riverboat deckhand and became a captain, then owned his own boat, and his fortunes grew from there. But then after the Civil War in the 1870s, he partnered with another Peoria well-known name, Woodruff. Yes, the guy the school was named after, who was a mayor forever. And so Detweiler and Woodruff started an ice house together. And Woodruff continued on his own when Detweiler kind of broke away and started his own warehouse. And Woodruff made a fortune in the ice industry as well as Detweiler. And they were amicable competitors, because when Woodruff was mayor, he invited Detweiler to be the city treasurer. So they continued to work together on a couple of projects.
Now, what was involved? We were talking with Brian Fox Ellis, who's, well, you hold many, many titles here: historian, storyteller, author, singer, just environmentalist. We could go on, but we're talking with Brian about the Illinois River as the sort of the refrigeration capital of central Illinois. What was involved in getting ice out of the river? You mean a team of horses go out there and they cut it, or how did that work?
Well, that's the other thing that's a little hard to believe with our recent spate of mild winters. But the river would freeze very thick enough that indeed a team of horses and wagons could go out, and a team of men with very large saws. I imagine, well, you can see pictures online, I'm sure, of the saws were like the saws that the lumbermen used to cut down the redwood trees. I mean, these are huge saws that would then cut blocks of ice. And then these blocks, typically a couple of foot square, would be loaded onto the wagons. And then the wagons on sleds instead of wheels. So the sleds would then haul the ice to the shore. And where Detweiler Marina stands today is where Detweiler's warehouse was. And this ice would be packed in together and layers of sawdust for insulation. And it was enough kind of... the ice kept itself cold. Temporal inertia, I think, is a term I might be making up, but the temperature had enough inertia. It was enough cold ice to keep itself cold that it would last even through the hottest summers. And it was not only important for central Illinois. Detweiler had a contract with Anheuser-Busch in St. Louis, because Busch beer from the mountains — there are no mountains in St. Louis, by the way — he preferred ice from the Illinois River than the muddy Mississippi. And so Detweiler's fortunes grew once he signed that contract with Busch.
And let's take it another step. So you have these vast warehouses like Detweiler's filled with ice, and you have the, I don't know if there were ice women, but the ice men cometh, right? I mean, they delivered to homes that had ice boxes.
Yeah, it was seasonal work in the winter to go out and cut the ice. People weren't buying much ice in the winter because they could, you know, leave things on their back porch or what have you. But then it was seasonal work the rest of the year to deliver that ice. And yeah, the ice trucks coming around was great fun, because as I've heard The Iceman cometh. That's a bad kind of comparison, but knowing the content of that movie. But the Iceman would come around the neighborhood, right, and he had a little scraper so that he could scrape the surface of the of this huge ice cube to get some shavings that he would then give to kids, and the kids would follow the ice truck around, and everybody looked forward to getting like a snow cone from the Iceman, in addition to the couple of blocks he would leave in your house.
How long did this go on? When the Iceman and the delivery of ice, I mean, I don't need a finite time, but did it run into the 30s or?
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve. I cannot pinpoint, but I know that Detweiler was involved in the 1870s with Illinois' growing ice business, and definitely until refrigeration and rural electrification, which happened under Roosevelt during the Depression. So yeah, mid 30s into the 40s, I would say even.
You know, I won't say recent because it's you know, we're talking about 80, 90 years ago, but still it's not, you know, sort of out of the frame of reference anymore. And it is hard to believe when we look at the Illinois River today that there was this budding industry. Of course, we haven't even talked about the fishing, which was yet another aspect of that river.
Yeah, that's another episode. But the ice business was huge, and it did employ a lot of people, and everybody had an ice box. And you're right, it wasn't that long ago, it wasn't that far away. If you go to good antique stores, sometimes you can even see the old ice boxes. And it is intriguing to me how they had this like pan or tray where they would put the ice cube, and then it was a heavily insulated wooden box that you could put your eggs and milk and vegetables or whatever in, like a modern ice box. And most people call it a refrigerator, but you still hear folks calling it the ice box because that vocabulary stuck around.
That's historian, author, and storyteller Brian Fox Ellis speaking with WCBU correspondent Steve Tarter. Postmark Peoria is a co-production of WCBU and Mike Sable. If you want even more stories about Peoria history, subscribe to the Postmark Peoria podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, or NPR One.
The NPR One app is public radio made personal. The newly redesigned app now includes both audio and text stories from NPR, so you can read or listen on your own schedule. You can also hear WCBU's best stories and podcasts. Learn more at wcbu.org/NPR1.
Thanks for listening to All Things Peoria this afternoon. I'm Daniel Musisi, and since it's Friday, it's time for Out and About. Each week, Out and About connects you to the arts community by talking with local arts leaders, artists, and performers. This week, Jen Gordon talks to Wendy Thomason, executive director of the Peoria Ballet, about the return of the Nutcracker to the Peoria Civic Center. This family holiday tradition features 100 dancers joined by professional guest artists dancing the roles of Drosselmeyer, Sugar Plum Fairy, and Cavalier, plus live music by the Heartland Festival Orchestra.
Wendy, it's so great to have you back on Out and About.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is truly a holiday tradition here in Peoria. Take me back in time and tell me a little bit about how long the Peoria Ballet has been producing the Nutcracker.
So we've been around since 1965. We don't know exactly the first Nutcracker because the records from the beginning aren't pristine, but we know since the early 70s.
Wow.
So we're getting, if we're not at 50 years, we're getting pretty close to that. And so it's just something that we always do. And it's something that people that maybe don't have a high interest in ballet or even classical music, they still want to come and see the Nutcracker. It's just something they do. It means the holidays to them. They're so familiar with the music because you hear that music everywhere you go. And it's so festive and upbeat. So it's something that we really love doing because it appeals to so many people.
One thing that I love that you do is you partner with the Heartland Festival Orchestra for that live music component. Obviously, that's going to augment the audience's experience. How does this hype in the dancers' experience as they're performing the Nutcracker?
It's such an incredible thing to see when we move into the theater. So we're at the Peoria Civic Center all week rehearsing, but we don't have the orchestra till Friday night. So our last dress rehearsal before we open to the public is when they arrive, they rehearse, and we start rehearsing with them. And the energy levels already increased just being at the theater. But when they get there on Friday, it's unreal what it does for everybody. I mean, just even the people that are backstage aren't performing. That whole backstage crew, it just elevates everything. And I know when we bring in guest artists for our Sugar Plum and Cavalier, it's something that is a huge selling point for them. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, a lot of productions don't have live music anymore. It's a considerable expense. And so it's something that some ballets can't do. And so that's something that we've really held on to strongly. That's something that we have to figure out a way to do. And we've done that. And they love it. It's such an amazing experience, even for the audience. I think sometimes they don't maybe recognize how different it's going to feel with that music booming out of the pit. But everything just hits you differently when you can feel that music that's actually coming from an instrument. And the other part of it is just to support other artists as part of what we want to do. Musicians love to play Nutcracker music. If you're a professional musician, you know it. You've played it. And it's just like a coming home for the musicians, too. So I think it's a great partnership that we can really help sustain some local musicians and keep that going and expose people to music. And I think our symphonies in Peoria do an excellent job of making their programming attractive to a wide range of people. And that's what we think Nutcracker does also. So we love that partnership with the Heartland Festival Orchestra, for sure.
I was really surprised and very impressed when I was reading your press release that over 100 dancers are performing in this production. I had no idea it was that large of a scale production.
Yes, traditionally that is the size of our cast. We've been in this situation for a year and a half. So our students know how they have to be at the studio to stay safe. And so we knew we could open it back up. So it was really exciting. We have students as young as 5 years old that are in the show. And so that kind of helped get those numbers back up to where they've been in the past. But it's a huge production. Most of our students participate. Mm-hmm. It's something that we do separate from class time, so it's not required. But so many students want to do it. And so it's going to be great to have all these students back on stage and just to have it feel like a full cast again this year.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Out and About on WCBU and WCBU.org. I'm Jen Gordon with Arts Partners, and today we're talking with the Peoria Ballet's Wendy Thomason about the Nutcracker Ballet happening December 11th and 12th at the Peoria Civic Center. So tell me about these guest artists that you bring in.
So we always bring in guests for Sugar Plum and Cavalier. They perform mainly at the very end of the Nutcracker. And I think it's kind of the dessert at the end of the meal. Mm-hmm. It's the part I really look forward to. Always gives me goosebumps. And I think what's great is we bring in these guests so that you don't have to go to New York or you don't have to go to Chicago. You can come to Peoria. And for a ticket that starts at $10, you have a chance to see a live orchestra and these amazing guest artists. So I think that's such a treat for the community, but also for our students, because they get to see how do professional dancers compose themselves? How do they warm up? What do they do to prepare to perform? And just have those connections. The people we bring in are always lovely artists that will stay backstage after the curtain goes down and take pictures, and they'll sign the older female students' point shoes. And they really make that connection with the students and inspire them. And so I think it's a treat for the community, but also for our students as well.
This is also a very special year for the Peoria Ballet as you're welcoming a new artistic director.
Yes, we have a new director, Ian Thatcher, and his wife, Molly Daly. They moved their family here in September and immediately took over. They taught for 1 week, had a Nutcracker audition on Saturday, and started rehearsing the following Tuesday. So they just hit the ground running. But just like I was saying about the guest artists we're able to bring in, we are very fortunate also to be able to bring in these really talented artistic directors. And for us to be able to attract these people to our community is so important. Ian and Molly both had very impressive performing careers, so they have that really strong foundation as professional dancers. But for the last 12 years, they have been focusing on teaching. So that's, of course, very important to us because that's the other component of what we do. And so they're both certified in the American Ballet Theater's teaching curriculum, which is a quite rigorous accreditation to have. And they just love teaching. Mm. You can just see it every day in the studio when they come in. They just love being with the kids. They love motivating them, working with them. You can tell they really understand children, which is important. Even when you have children, doesn't mean you know how to educate them. So it's just been, they've had so much excitement, enthusiasm. You know, artists are creative individuals. And so that's what they do. They're creating and doing new things. And so when you bring in new people, they just bring in a whole new set of goals and ideals. And I know they are really excited about being here and really building and taking us to the next level. So it's an exciting time.
That was Wendy Thomason of the Peoria Ballet talking about their upcoming production of The Nutcracker, happening December 11th and 12th at the Peoria Civic Center Theater. For tickets and information, you can visit peoriaballet.com. Wendy, thank you so much for keeping this tradition alive.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's another great weekend to be out and about in Peoria. The 6th Annual Festival of Nativities will be held at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. and on Sunday from noon to 6 p.m. The festival includes nearly 1,000 nativities from over 40 countries, as well as live musical performances from local choirs, churches, and schools. And A Christmas Carol, the musical, will be happening at the Scottish Rite Theater tonight and tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. To learn more about these and all upcoming arts events, you can visit artspartners.net.
You've been listening to Out and About, a production of WCBU and Arts Partners of Central Illinois with your host, Jen Gordon. Three performances will be offered December 11th and 12th, with tickets starting at $10. You can subscribe to the Out and About podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and you can hear it every Friday here on All Things Peoria. I'm Daniel Musisi. We had story help today from Mike Rundle, Steve Tarter, and Jen Gordon. You can find all of today's stories at WCBU.org. That's also where you'll find links to subscribe to the All Things Peoria podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of the show, so comment on our Facebook page. We're Peoria Public Radio. Or follow us on Twitter at WCBU Radio. This is WCBU Peoria, 89.9 FM, and WCBU.org, a public service of Bradley University and Illinois State University.